Thank you so much for coming out this evening. I figured we might all be exhausted, so it's nice to see a full room. So I thought we would go ahead and get started, and I wanted to just get on the record Phil's biography. Philip Deloria is your full name, but you go by Phil, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. I didn't want to be calling you a nickname without your permission. So Philip Deloria is the Carol Smith Rosenberg Collegiate Professor in the College of Literature, Science, and the Arts at the University of Michigan, where he also has appointments in the Departments of History and American Culture and programs in the Environment and Native American Studies. His research focuses on the social, cultural, and political histories of the relations between American Indians and the United States. His prize-winning 1998 book, Playing Indian, traced Indian play, and I'm using his quotation marks, from the Boston Tea Party to the New Age movement. His 2004 book, Indians in Unexpected Places, there's one copy, ladies and gentlemen, you can scramble for it after the conversation, examined the ideologies surrounding Indian people in the early 20th century and the ways Native Americans challenged them through sports, travel, automobility, and film and musical performance. He's in the process now of completing two new books, American Studies, A User's Guide, which surveys methods of interpretation and writing. Hooray. And Toward an American Indian Abstract, an extended piece of art criticism. Although I feel like you said there was a third thing you were working on in our email exchange. Is that a secret?
It's not, actually. I'm co-editing with Beth Pieto from the University of California, Berkeley, a book called Indian's Heart, Nixon, which is it's an effort to see, you know, there's a couple of really good, funny American Indian writers, Tom King, Sherman Alexie, and then there's the rest of us who would like to be funny writers, but are not. And so we're inviting the non-funny writers to try to be funny, but pointed. So yes, it's kind of fun.
That will be fun. I might have a lead or two for you.
Okay.
Oh wait, it's probably already in the works. It might be
too
late.
No. There's a call out actually.
So, oh, fantastic.
Yes, anybody can send in stuff.
So I usually start right in with talking about process. But I'm really interested right now into looking into your sort of past writing in what brought you to writing about your particular subject area. Because I think it's important for students to know what our commitments are as writers. So I thought we'd start there.
Well, so I had a very long and circuitous path, you know, kind of into and out of Native American studies. And neither of these books are really, well, the first book certainly is not truly Native American studies. It's really American cultural studies. So as some of you may or may not know, and if you don't, I'll tell you, you know, my dad, Vine Deloria Jr., was a, you know, really prominent American Indian sort of intellectual activist, writer, thinker. And so, you know, for me growing up, actually one of the things I didn't want to do was to be an American Indian writer, thinker, et cetera, et cetera. So I was a music nerd. I was a band nerd. And I went to school as an undergrad as a music performance major. I played the trombone. I played the guitar on the side and was shoved into playing the bass a lot because I wasn't that good a guitar player. And was a middle school band and orchestra teacher for 2 years. And then I coached basketball and played in a band and had kind of a lost year after I just got married, which made my wife super unhappy. And then I did a master's degree in broadcast journalism because I'd been working in music video as a kind of crew guy. And then I did my PhD in American Studies. And so I had a very, very long kind of circuitous kind of career. And as I was in my American Studies program, I really kind of thought of myself more as a communication studies person. But this book, Playing Indian, this first book, White People Who Dress Up Like Indians, basically I was a teaching assistant for a guy named Bill Cronin, environmental historian. And we were sitting in lecture, and he put up a slide. Actually, people in my environmental history class, Dylan, saw this slide yesterday as we were talking about the same thing. We were talking about child rearing and nurture, changing gender roles at the turn of the 20th century. He put up a slide of this group called the Woodcraft Indians. This guy, Ernest Thompson Seton, had gotten boys dressed up like Indians running around a campfire in order to kind of teach them about masculinity and sort of like rescue them from, urban degradation and things. So the slide is up there. Bill Cronin is saying, this was Ernest Thompson Seton's group, Woodcraft Indians, and next to me, Gunther Peck, very fine labor historian, turned and said, have you ever heard of this group called this Improved Order of Red Men? And I had, right, because there are these fraternal lodges around, and I used to ski when I grew up in Colorado, ski at Winter Park, and if you're driving back, if people know this geography, you're driving back from Winter Park, you go through Empire, little town with a little Improved Order of Red Men lodge, and I thought it was so weird I'd stop there one time. And so there was this moment, little white kids dressed up like Indians, fraternal guys dressed up like Indians, Boston Tea Party where they dressed up like Indians, Boulder, Colorado, where I was from, where they all dressed up like Indians in the 80s during like new waves, new age stuff, you know? And so like literally the idea for the book like exploded in my head and unfolded in about 60 seconds. Yeah, it was kind of, I've never had an experience like it. It was pretty amazing. And then after that, it was kind of like execute, you know, research and execute. The second book though was like really long and drawn out essays that extended over a long period of time.
Yeah. So it wasn't born in your mind immediately like this one was, like Playing Indian was?
No, I mean, I've been really, in this book there's a lot of interesting weird stuff, right? I was interested in weird stuff that Indians were doing that nobody expected them to do, but I hadn't actually put a frame on it. So as a musician, I was interested in like what I'd call the sound of Indian, right? Which for musicians, descending minor third with a short long rhythm. Da-da-da-da, Indians, right? Ah, dang, how did that happen historically, right? So I was interested in that question. I've been doing a little bit of work about Indians and cars, and I just wrote it up as a conference paper. And then I thought, oh, I'm going to teach a class about Indians doing weird stuff. I'd been interested in Buffalo Bill and the fact that he used to recruit from the same reservations, Pine Ridge Reservation, for like 30 years. And what did that mean over 30 years? It meant there was an entire generation of Indian wage workers in the performance industry. So I had these things that were itchy and weird. I had a Pawnee guy who was a pole sitter in the 1920s, an Indian roller skating champion. I assembled all this stuff. I was thinking of it as a class, but I hadn't really pulled it together. And then I was having lunch with this editor at the University of Kansas Press, University Press of Kansas, Nancy Jackson, who said, you know, you could, this stuff's kind of interesting. You could do like a little short one-off book for us. It'd be super quick. Just assemble all your conference papers together and we'll have a book. And of course, that turned out not to work. I actually ended up having to make a more systematic argument. But the structure of the book is really different. And there's a whole section in it justifying the essay as an exploratory form, as opposed to the long-form argument, really, of the first book.
Really cool. So at what point did you say to yourself, oh, I've become an intellectual who talks about Indian culture?
Yeah, well, so the first book, one of the critiques of the first book was sort of, you know, kind of my ideas about race were formed in a vacuum that didn't have a lot of social history in it, right? Because there's not a lot of Indians in this book. There's really only two moments where white people who are dressing like Indians actually run into Indians. And so, you know, people were wondering more about the kind of material world in which this stuff happened. The second book, you know, is much, it's kind of a, they're bookends, if you will, right? The second book is much more concerned with material Indian lives in place. And that, you could argue that that book really started, the first serious essay was an essay about my grandfather. And for those who know it, it starts with a kind of encounter with me and him while he's in the midst of, he's suffering from Alzheimer's. And I sort of tell him, yeah, I came from Connecticut to see you. And he goes into one of these Alzheimer's kind of flashes about being a football player and playing football against the Connecticut Aggies. And that moment, that was a really revelatory moment for me because, you know, he was very, very well known as an Episcopal clergyman. He was very well known as an Indian kind of a language resource, right? He knew a lot of old language stuff from the 19th century. So anthropologists like to interview him. So this is how I always saw him. And I had never really framed him as an athlete until this moment. And then all of a sudden, I had a little mini mind explosion about all the ways in which, in fact, he was an incredibly physical person. And then I started thinking more about Indian athletes. And I started thinking about Jim Thorpe as the only Indian athlete that anybody actually knows, when, in fact, there's a whole world of people like my grandfather, you know, kind of out there. So I ended up starting that book in some ways in a very personal way that wasn't so much the case here, and expanding it out into those questions about material lives, yeah, you know, kind of on the ground.
So you're starting to answer, I'm getting a little bit of a picture now of how the next idea comes to you. But now that you are now that you're a professor, and you might be, well, you may not be under the gun for publication anymore. But
I'm done. I'm a full professor. I don't have to write anything ever again.
Now you can write whatever you want.
I can write whatever I want.
So does your next idea usually come from a place of you just wait to be inspired, or do you go and actually seek out opportunities to write?
So, you know, I like all of us should, right? I kind of keep these idea files kind of floating around in my head. Well, and sometimes actually I write them down. It's a good thing. You know, so the next big project I'm going to do, which you and I haven't even talked about, is one I've been carrying around for a long time. And I think it's like, where do ideas come from, right? I mean, you know, it's interesting with all the sort of entrepreneurship stuff on campus. It's a lot of stuff about ideation and how you figure out a structure for generating ideas. And I do have a couple of those structures, you know, like the long shower is a good thing for me. You know, I'm a fan of the John Lennon moment, right? Like, I'm kind of asleep, but I'm kind of half awake, and I'm going to sit here and I'm going to muse, and sometimes the ideas are going to be really bad, but sometimes they're going to be kind of interesting, right? I'm going to, you know, do those kinds of things. But I always, and there's a bunch of my students are out here, and you guys will have heard me say these kinds of things before, but, you know, I think, like, to get ideas, you just have to move through the world with full 100% attention, and, like, we can't do that all the time. The moments when we can have full 100% attention, in the Thoreauvian sense, my friends, right? That's the moment. Yeah, you can hear them back there. You know, those are the moments where you actually see stuff, right? You see stuff, and you don't let it pass you by. I think that's the first trick is to see stuff. The second step is to not let it pass you by. Like, so often, you know, an idea comes by you, something is weird in the world, you think, ah, that's weird, right? And then you just move on. But in fact, I think for me, grabbing the weirdness, the little weird thread, and pulling on a little bit, mm-hmm. sometimes it leads nowhere, but sometimes it leads to really interesting things. So this next project is basically, on November 12th, 1833, right, there's this meteor storm that's visible all across the continent. And the meteor storm is so intense, right, that everybody sees it. Like, nobody, there's no group of people who cannot not see it. And so everybody on the continent basically runs out of their house and says, dang, like, there's something like 250,000 meteors an hour that are falling. So it's like a spin in a snow globe. These are kind of the descriptions of this stuff. So, you know, I came across this at one point. It's the calendrical marker on Plains Indian winter counts, 1833, the year the stars fell. Oh, God, there's a great title, too. Yeah. Thank you.
Do you want to write it down?
Thank you. No, I got it. It's done. There's already a book out there called The Year the Stars Fell, which is about pictographic calendars, right? Other people notice that besides just me, you know? So, but, you know, I kind of like, oh, that's interesting. This is how these calendars all line up. And then I started playing with the idea more and realizing that, you know, in a kind of world of different sort of social groups, right, that actually if you could find a moment in time and place that everybody had the unifying experience and that experience was epistemologically challenging, like the world's ending, this would be a super cool book, right? So that next project's gonna be a big synthetic survey over space locked into a specific kind of moment in time.
Oh, that'll be really interesting.
I know, I think it'll be good.
Yeah.
I hope. We'll
I read somewhere that a similar phenomenon occurred in ancient Roman times, and this is actually picked up on in Julius Caesar and Shakespeare's Caesar, because that's what gets start the whole play. Mm. Gets started as everyone is
right,
talking about fire
right,
falling out
right,
of the sky.
Right.
And it turns out it was a big meteor.
Yeah. Sure. You know, I think it turns out really, if you started to pursue this stuff in a bigger scale, you would find over time, right, volcanoes blowing up, meteors, comets, all these different moments where people have to sort of confront, you know, epistemological stuff because the heavens are giving you something that's just outside your daily experience. I mean, you know, it's oftentimes construed in terms of like supermoons or eclipses and stuff. Like, I think that's small potatoes, right? This stuff is like the big stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
So what's your writing process like? So you've got your idea, then what?
So I would say it's different if I'm on leave and I'm not.
Right? Okay. Let's start with if you're on leave.
So last year I was on leave. So I think the first thing for me is like morning, God, not to sound Thoreauvian again, right? But like morning is that good time, right? Morning is the time. And if you distract yourself by answering email or doing other stuff, right, you won't do your best writing. So what I try to do is I like breakfast, so I eat. And I try to be in front of the computer at 8 o'clock. And I try to set up a discipline for myself around time. And so it's like, I'm there at 8. I'm going to write till 10:30. And I'm trying to make that actual writing labor, not correcting stuff, not editing stuff. I mean, I do tend to sort of read the pages that I've written previously as a way of kind of like the runway into the rhythm, right, of getting going. But I don't go and do line editing or anything like that. I kind of read them through, and then I try to take off again. I mean, I try to write really solid for you know, 2.5 hours maybe. And then I have to stop and do something really physical. So, you know, I'll go take a walk, I'll do jumping jacks and push-ups, you know, I'll, you know, whatever, I'll do something like that, but I won't make it a long break, you know, kind of half hour, and then I'll go back and I'll try to write for another hour and a half or 2 hours, and then I'll stop, eat, take a much longer break, and then I'll come back in kind of a later afternoon, and I'll do more mundane stuff, right? So that might be kind of line editing. There might be a moment in there to answer email, and the bane of us all, right? But I actually try to push that off if I can. And, like, I will go days without even looking at it, which is super hard to do, and I don't have the discipline to do it that often. But, you know, but I think if you're actually committed to writing, it would be great if you could turn it off, but you kind of can't. Because you need to Google stuff, right?
Right.
Yeah.
How does that work when you're not on leave?
It's brutal if you're not on leave, right? I mean, so if I'm not on leave, so I've tried to finish, for example, an essay for this Indians Heart Nixon collection about spa music. And it's a short little piece, right? It's me trying to be funny, right? I know. It's me trying to be funny, or if not funny, it's not that funny, actually.
Do you want to show us how not funny it is at some point?
I've got a little piece of it, if you'd like to see a little piece of it.
Yeah, we should. You want to hear some?
Yeah,
okay. But the bottom line is, I totally squeeze that in, you know, and it's like, if I can eke out an hour and a half, you know, maybe it's an afternoon, maybe it's a morning or something like that, it's, you just have to, like, have the discipline to kind of write. And it's definitely, your writing is not of the same quality.
Yeah.
So you definitely have to go back and kind of, you know, rethink stuff. So, okay, so this is, you know, this is kind of goofy, right? I'll just tell you up front.
I thought spa was a typo in the email. I thought, does he mean ska?
Unless ska would be ska would be cool. So the setup on this thing, right, is, I mean, it starts with this big, long, kind of laborious description about spa luxury, right? About the sandals and the lemon water shower and all this stuff to, right, kind of set you up in a way. And then there's a kind of riff about, like, how this is the life, right? This is the good life, right? This is what the spa thing is. And then there's this kind of, an account of this kind of massage that's, and so it's a trickster story, right? It's an American Indian trickster story. So the massage is being given by this kind of hipster who wants to be called Spider-Man, right? Of course, the spider thing, that spider is the obvious thing. Although I gotta say, Beth, I think sort of missed it. It was like the spider, Iktomi, is a trickster kind of, you know, figure. So I'm being, the me getting a massage is I'm being kind of like, brutalized by this this massage therapist who plays two pieces of music, right? Like, plays a Eric Satie piano kind of deal, and then plays like a new agey synthy kind of thing, or plays like a Wyndham Hill guitar thing, or, you know, plays something. So after the first two songs play, the massage therapist stops and says, "Which one do you like better?" And refuses to go on until I say which one I like better. So I say which one I like better. And then two more things play, and which one do you like better? And I have to keep responding. And after a while, I start to get very tense in my massage because there's this weird kind of thing going on. And it's a weird kind of mapping, right? So there's, like, you know, the Australian composer Percy Aldrich Grainger's arrangement of the Irish tune Danny Boy, you know, faces off against didgeridoo music, right? And it turns out that that's actually the key. So the key is that what I've been asked to do, what this trickster figure is asking me to do as a massage person, is to choose between colonial winners and losers, basically. So, oh yeah, it's an Australian guy being faced off against Australian Aboriginal people. And the sort of trick at the end of it is that I have chosen the colonial victor over the Aboriginal and Indigenous person in every instance. And so it's like my massage makes me feel terrible, you know. I mean, it's really terrible. So I've been kind of tricked. And so then there's this kind of thing about the life. So I'll just, okay. When you spa, you're commanded by the robe, the aromatherapy, the oil infusions to think, yeah, this is the life. This is the life. And it's the that matters. The life is aspirational. The spa tells you how life should be, could be. You're meant to desire that different life, one that drops the such that you can simply and always say, yeah, this is life. Every day is rich scents and gentle touches, perfect temperatures and sweet music. Nobody gets to live that life, except that some people kind of do. The winners do. Winners live in a giant spa world. Near winners visit periodically and fantasize. Losers don't go in at all ever. Because the fantasy of the spa world is that there are no losers. The world of good stuff simply is, without anyone bearing the consequences involved in making that world so spa-licious. Should I have been surprised that every time Spider-Man forced me to choose, I picked a winner? That's what the spa is. Its fantasy aura dripped straight down into my heart and soul from the moment I entered the locker room and left my own losses behind in a rainwater shower. But Spider-Man proved the fly in the aromatherapy ointment, pushing a kind of soul-scraping bodywork. He forced me to choose, pummeled me until I did, and then pummeled me for my choices. And this is his voice. You think gentle massage is life? No, life is hair pulling, which he does to me. Elbows to the spine, knuckles to the bottom of the feet, hard choices forced on people who don't want to choose. Life is winners, people or nations, it doesn't much matter. Walking hard over losers, pressing them down. Massage is not life, and life is not massage. It's the delusion and privilege of the winner. There's more here too, but you know, that's more than enough, right? I mean, it's not really very funny.
It's ironic funny.
Yeah, thanks. That's cool.
Yeah, I like that. For people who don't know, what is a trickster story?
Well, so, you know, so most Native American traditions have a kind of trickster figure who's a kind of crazy. I mean, in Dakota traditions, it's, you know, Iktomi, a spider. Sometimes it's a coyote. Sometimes it's a raven. Trickster can do crazy stuff, you know, because there's a little bit of there's crazy sexual stuff sometimes. There's a shape-shifting. And, I mean, to me, it's a kind of philosophical kind of position, actually, that comes out of indigenous cultures where the trickster is both. The trickster represents the simultaneities of life in the world, right? Because the trickster is oftentimes being tricked at the same moment that the trickster is tricking someone, right? So the trickster tells the mice who are having a party in a buffalo skull that he's a mouse too, and the mice invite him in, and ha ha ha, isn't that a funny trick, right? The trickster has tricked the mice, but then the magic ends, and the trickster's got a buffalo skull on his head, and the trickster has been tricked, and then the trickster has to smash his head against a rock to get the buffalo skull off, and then his head hurts, and so it's these kind of layers of simultaneity, which I think is actually an important indigenous sort of epistemological position, right? Here's how to live by knowing how not to live. Here's how not to live by knowing how to live, right? These mm-hmm. things constantly echo. And there's other figures in which that happens. Yeah.
So is this your first attempt at sort of essay, the personal narrative, short fiction? How would you describe
it? It's mashup. Fictional. Yeah, it is fictional. It's my first attempt at short fiction. Damn. Right.
That's exciting.
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've written kind of, I got in a kick at one point of writing, trying to write poetry, but only on the occasion when people died. Because when you have to write that condolence card, right, and you don't really know what to say, but you know you must say something, right? And I ended up with a number of people who, some of whom I knew well and some of whom I didn't, who had suffered losses, you know? And I felt like, you know, if there's ever an occasion where you wanted to try to actually be expressive with language, right, and be emotional, like that, and say something of love and care to another person, like that was the moment, and that they would probably tolerate your poetry if it was bad because, like, the feeling was right, right? You know, so good. So I wrote a number of these kind of very sad sort of, you know, poems that way, and then I realized that, like, really good poets are really good, and, like, I'm really kind of not, and so I stopped. I stopped.
I'm not sure I've ever figured out what really good poetry is, so I just trust my friends who are poets to tell me.
Yeah, well, maybe these were great poems, and I just didn't know it.
It's undiscovered.
I like to think that. I mean, the other thing that I try to do is, I'm a really bad songwriter. So for a couple of years, I taught this songwriting class. I'm hoping I can teach it again, too, you know, because songwriting actually requires, you know, it's not poetry, despite Dylan, well-deserved, you know, Nobel Prize, right? I mean, it's not really the same as poetry, but it requires certain kinds of writing disciplines and strategies. And actually, when I'm teaching songwriting, The first time I taught it, I really jumped in around lyric, you know, and writing lyric, and how do you do it, and what's a perfect rhyme, and what's imperfect, and how far, you know, can you go, and, you know, those kinds of things. What I realized is that most of my students, they were all aspirational alt-folk kind of guitar heroes, right, but none of them could sing. So when I changed the course, the second time I taught the course, it was like, no, I'm going to get my friend Melody Racine from the music school down, and we're going to take voice lessons, you know, and we're going to start with melody rather than start with lyric, right? So the idea was, you can come into a song, right, through melody, come into it through lyric, come into it through harmony, chord progressions, come in it through beat, rhythm, those kinds of things. But I realized all my students, they needed to come into it through, you know, through melody.
Yeah. So this takes us to your teaching, I think, really well. So what kinds of writing do you assign to your students when you're not teaching music writing? And how do you see those as connected?
Yeah, you know, well, it's a bunch of my students here, right? So, for example, in my environmental history class this year, you know, what I'm doing is I'm really interested in sort of the big, long project, right? I mean, you know, greatest predictor of success in graduate school is writing a senior thesis, a long-form argument, you know, with evidence, those kinds of things, right? So I can't really do that, but it is important to me then to sort of think, well, what's the baby version of that? And of course, to do a project, to do scaffolded writing, to try to get people kind of up to speed, you know, on various things, which is also about teaching how history works and how history's written. It's a little less about teaching narrative writing and more about teaching structure. And, you know, for me, you know, thinking about teaching writing historically or in the historic, you know, kind of realm, thinking about structure and argument is the most important thing. It's more important than voice, more important than narrative. Those things can actually be worked with later, but if you don't have a good question, you don't have a good structure to get there, you know, you're gonna, and we see this, you know, a lot in books that our colleagues publish, in the works that our grad students are doing, in the works that we do, right, where narrative fluidity and narrative skill so often compensates for inadequacies in argument. Right, and I'm as guilty of it as the next person, right? But I think to be self-conscious of it, I think my job as a teacher is in some ways to force, you know, good argumentative and analytical structure, and then to help people get to narrative structures on top. You know, so I do that in that class. There's a couple of folks from my Camp Davis class who are here, and you guys actually were spared the writing project that we usually do. We did an experiment with a digital platform last year, but in that class, you know, students should maybe show up on a Sunday afternoon. And then they're turning in a finished paper by Thursday night that goes from, so there it is, like 4 days, and we're going to conceptualize, you know, a 7-page primary source researched analytical paper really fast. So it's fantastic, fun teaching, you know, about writing because, you know, we're just with them 24/7. And we're always talking, what's your project? What are you doing? How are you, you know, of course, they're feeling deeply pressured to, like, write a big paper in 4 days, you know, but... But I found that, like, that compressed form and the kind of hands-on stuff, you can actually do better writing instruction in that than you can over the course of a semester. And you can deal with a much bigger range of stuff.
How so?
Well, because you're kind of always with them, and so you're in a constant dialogue back and forth. Whereas, you know, when you've got a structure where assignments are coming in and they're, you know, and it's like there's space and gap between there. Mm-hmm. The intensity of it, I think, the realization that, like, you have to sit down at the students have to sit down at the computer and they got to do it now. Mm. You don't feel that same intensity, you know, in a semester-long class. Right? And I think you can kind of build off that kind of burn that they feel like, yeah. You know, like, no, you got to get going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what are your research methods that you tend to go to, and how do you teach your students research? Because it seems to me like writing and research are inextricably intertwined, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if I'm in an archive, you know, I've always got my computer open when you read a source or something and you think, oh my gosh, like a lot of times analysis sort of explodes or interpretive stuff explodes in your head and you've got to write it down. If you don't write it down, you're going to lose it, right? So the writing and that kind of research kind of, you know, goes together. I mean, you know, it's sort of depending on the nature of the assignment. In this environmental history class, everybody's got a place. And, you know, the idea is let's go up to the Bentley Library and let's see what kinds of place stuff is out there for us. You know, now I took the class up. They kind of forgot that, I mean, I don't want to speak for everyone in the class, but they kind of forgot that we'd gone to the Bentley Library, and I have to keep reminding people, Dylan, right? Exactly. You got to go up to the Bentley Library. There's good stuff there. You're going to find it. It's super cool. Mm-hmm. Right. So, So, you know, that's very standard stuff. Like, okay, here's a primary source. Now, how do you work with it? I think it's really, really important to teach interpretive kinds of skills. So I spent a lot of time, like, here's an image. How do we read an image? How's reading an image like reading a text, mm-hmm. right? What do you see in that picture? You know, I mean, for me, it's very standard stuff. It comes out of our art historical analysis, right? Defamiliarize yourself. Describe the thing in great detail. Right? Make deductions about it. Speculate creatively. Let your imagination go. Do research to generate answers to the questions that are generated out of your speculation. I mean, I say it over and over and over again. It's true. It's my method. It's kind of how it works. You know, it's art historical, and it comes to me through Jules Proun, who took that methodology and converted it into a material culture kind of analysis. And it's kind of the way I do everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what totally delights you when you see it in a student's paper?
What delights me? Well, I'd say two things. One is, you know, a kind of gem of interpretive insight, right, at the textual level. And this is not hard to produce, right? Like a lot of student papers, you see this, and it's great, and it's fun, and I always feel a great deal of satisfaction when it happens, because I think, well, maybe I had something to do with that. I don't know. Maybe I did. But, right, so I love to see the kind of, you know, kind of little moments of interpretive kind of light, you know, sort of shining out of the paper. I also really like to see kind of moments where people, I think, you know, maybe kind of rise above themselves in terms of kind of a moment of narrative voice, a moment of a turn of phrase, right? That you know, because we all have this as writers, right? Moments where we write beyond our what we perceive to be our own capacities, right? Mm-hmm. So if I can imagine that and I see what I think is that in a student paper, I'm really excited, right? Because
yeah.
And it's like, yeah, that's when I write a lot of comments in the margins. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, how do you respond?
Well, actually, I've been trying to move away from comments in the margins.
Me too. It's hard.
Well, I mean, what I've been doing is I've been doing a combination of Jing, you know, mm-hmm. kind of responses, right? So little mini video responses combined with some light margin comments. So basically what I'll kind of do is, you know, I'll maybe have 5 margin comments that I make, and then I'll send a little video, which is sort of like, usually I have a screenshot of the paper, actually. But then I think just like the human voice talking through it is better. Like, I know, right? We could do a student poll right here, like, when you get a word perfect, you know, kind of paper back and you've got all these margin comments, like, how many of you really, truly, like, read them and engage them? Okay, for the radio listeners, only one person raised his hand.
Oh, there
right.
was one?
Oh, yeah, the only raised his hand. Right, because actually most people, like, and me too, right? You kind of see these things, you're like, I don't think I want to go there. But I think the personality of sort of hearing a voice, or better, you know, even a kind of visual and a voice going together, if you can actually look at someone or sort of convey with your voice, like, I really do like you. I think you're super cool. Your writing is not your personality, right? It's just an editing problem. That's all.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Yeah.
Sorry, now that had all kinds of radio silence because I was thinking about that and responding. I think it's going to be soon time for us to move into Q&A, so I want to make sure. Oh, what is the one thing, speaking of engaging as a person and saying, hey, I think you're really cool and smart and you can do this, what is the one thing you wish that you could convince students to do? I guess part of it is go back to the Bentley. but what else do you wish you could get students to do that you find it difficult to persuade them?
Well, I would say, like, to take really seriously the drafting process, right? I think too often, you know, what we get is a kind of a first draft once over lightly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and this is a very easy thing to do, but... in this art book, for example, I had a super productive writing season last September and October, and I probably wrote, you know, 250 single space pages. I write single space when I'm kind of writing first. You know, so I had a lot of stuff, and a lot of it I really liked, you know, But the structure of it wasn't quite right, you know, and I had to be honest about that, and that's, I think, the advantage of being open to multiple draftings, is to say, like, I didn't nail it. I never nail it the first time through. Nobody really kind of does. So I, like, completely ripped apart the structure and everything. And I think, like, you know, to truly be a good writer, you have to be amenable, you know, to doing that kind of thing. Because it's really, it's the second stage of analysis, right? Your first stage is kind of just getting it down. Your thinking, writing processes, are they're paired together, they're inextricable. But then when you stop and you see what you have, a lot of times, I mean, I've advised many, many students to do this, like, just stop, pause, put the thing aside, step back, and think hard about, you know, the kind of bushy tree diagram of questions. Like, this is another thing that, like, my students are smiling, right? You know, like, you have one primary question that's going to drive a project, right? You don't have two, you don't have four, you don't have three, you have one, right? And if you can't say clearly what that one thing is, like, then you need to keep working. And then you got to think, what are my second order questions that are going to get me to that, right? Things that aren't answered through evidence, only answered through analysis, right? So what I did was exactly what I advised my students to do, which is super hard and it was painful, which was to step back, ask myself all those questions, and re-diagram the entire structure of argument, right, and analysis, and then reframe the entire thing. And what it ended up being was this incredible, like, inside out washing machine kind of redo of the entire structure of the thing, you know. And, you know, so, but this is hard, right? It's super hard, and it's very time consuming, and it's painful, and it's not easy. But I think if there's one way to sort of think about getting to be a better writer, it's to do that, be able to be honest with yourself about, you know, where your organization and your argument actually sit.
Yeah, I love that. Same, if you're a teacher in the room, same. Yeah, we can reiterate that for you. Okay, so I think what we should do now is move to the list of quick fire questions so that we can open up to the rest of the room to ask their own questions. So for those of you who are new to the Writer to Writer series, we have shamelessly cribbed the last segment of Inside the Actor's Studio, where they ask the series of the same questions to everyone who's visiting. Only we've slightly adapted them for writerly concerns and also to avoid vulgarity on the radio. So first question, what's your favorite word?
I'm so tempted to say something really vulgar.
There is time to edit, so you could say it, and then we could take it back.
You know, I mean, I have words that kind of come and go in and out of my life. I will tell you right now, and people will recognize this, my favorite word is itchy, right? I mean, itchy is the sort of metaphor for me, sort of for paying attention and seeing things and grabbing stuff out of the stream. And so I've been using that word a lot. I will get tired of it shortly, and I'll stop using it, but right now, my favorite word.
What's your least favorite word?
Impactful.
Oh, yeah.
I hate it as a noun, I hate it as a verb, and I really hate it as an adjective.
Yeah. Is it even an adjective?
No!
No. What's your least favorite over or misused word?
Intervention.
Oh. Academic.
And this comes from being, you know, in the American culture program.
What's your favorite overused word that you like to use anyway?
Intervention.
What thrills you as a writer?
What thrills me as a writer? Let me go back to that moment where you kind of write beyond,
yeah.
yourself, and you read yourself and you think, damn, that's not as bad as I thought it was, right? Yeah. That is a kind of a nice moment.
It is a really nice moment.
Yeah.
What about as a reader?
What thrills me as a reader? Well, I'd say, you know, I am a lover of the good turn of phrase, right? Mm-hmm. The turn of phrase that doesn't call attention to itself, but, like, kind of hits you, right? So the quiet good turn of phrase, not the sort of overt stylistic, I'm going to nail you with it, right? And this is kind of the problem that we have as writers. I mean, I think you can see this in this thing. Like, I'm trying for good turns of phrases, you know, they're a little too obvious, right? Mm-hmm. So for me, like, this less obvious turn of phrase that I have to think about. Like, I think it's beautiful, it's cool. The longer I stay with it, the better I like it.
That's the more it shows.
I love
you.
That stuff, yeah.
What repels you as a writer?
What repels me as a writer? Writing on my laptop. I gotta say, like, the very best thing is to have two giant screens. Like, that's, like, the best thing. That's what I love as a writer.
Does your writing go across both screens? Is it, like, leap screens, or does it?
No, it's not that big.
Wow.
But a lot of times what I'll have, especially right now when I'm writing about art, I'll have the art on one side and I'll have my stuff on the other. And, you know, and it's really, it's great to have it big and to have it, and to have, yeah.
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 What about what repels you as a reader?
What repels me as a reader? I think, So it both attracts and repels me, but I would say writing that is kind of sentimental and emotive to the point that it moves me to tears, right? Because I immediately resent it, you know, unless it's like, God, I sound like Hemingway in the Woody Allen movie, right?
As long as it is good and true and pure, it is good.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's like, so I'm a guy who like easily cries, right? I cry in movies. I can't watch tense movies because I get like my stomach gets all knotted up. And because sometimes when I'm, you know, reading stuff, I'll get like a little teary, right? And, but I immediately like, I've got the cynical streak on the other side of that, right? So it's like, I don't like writing that kind of takes me there in ways that are,
manipulative?
Pure, yeah, manipulative, mm-hmm. right. Even though they're effective, even though they're super effective, right? You know, so like I weep at the end of Field of Dreams, and then I'm mad at myself, right?
Every time.
Yeah.
Whose writing style, other than your own, would you like to attempt?
Would I like to attempt? Well, we're doing Native American literary stuff. I want to do a little push here for Louise Erdrich, right? Mm. Who I think is like, you know, fantastic, amazing, like both as a stylist, but also as a structural writer, mm-hmm. you know? And, you know, I think like that's a person you could imagine as an aspirational, you know, for me, an aspirational figure, right? Her politics are there, right? Complex kinds of stuff, funny, right? Turns of, right? So, you know, yeah.
Yeah, not manipulative at all either.
No.
So whose writing style, other than your own, would you absolutely not ever like to attempt?
Would I not like to attempt? Hemingway in the movie, Woody Allen movie.
And then finally, what three or four writers, living or dead, would you invite to an ideal writing workshop / retreat?
Let's see. I would invite Mary Oliver, who's like my favorite poet in the world in terms of like being able to like just nail down a phrase and be super smart. Mm-hmm. So that'd be not my number one pick. My number two pick would be John McPhee, just because he's like such a kind of clear writer and as a kind of guy who sort of like is able to bring, like, so I love environmental history and I love the geology part of environmental history, and the fact that like a guy can take geology and make it such clean, beautiful writing, you know, it's so, I've loved John McPhee for the longest possible time, and I also know him to be a really great writing teacher. So if we're workshopping, it'd be cool to have John McPhee around. And I would say my friend Carlo Rotella, who teaches writing at Boston College and is, I think, like the, you know, he's the apostle of craft in terms of writing, structure, thought, analysis. You know, as an American studies writer, you know, he is my favorite American studies writer, I would say. And then here's my fourth, would be my colleague Taya Miles, who is so sort of like, to think about someone who's actually concerned with the affect of writing, the affective experience of writing, the affective experience of her readers, and the ways in which affect and history really engage. Taya is so thoughtful on that and so committed to that. That feels like a dream team sort of kind of, you know.
I like it. Did you say Taya Miles?
Mm-hmm.
How's that spelled?
T-I-Y-A.
For everyone listening, Taya Miles, T-I-Y-A. Go read some of her work.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So at the end, we'd like to turn it over to people in the audience to ask their own questions. And now is the time for that. And I will bring a microphone to you if you have a question. Okay.
Hi, so I'm curious how you work with outside readers, and at what point you start sharing your work with other people, because I know you to be an excellent reader of other people's work. So how does that work with your own writing process?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I'd say earlier on, I had more structured kind of writing circles. So in these unexpected places, I wrote with Penny Von Eschen, Carol Smith Rosenberg, and Sonia Rose, which was a great writing circle. It was fantastic, you know. And we swapped chapters, you know, kind of back and forth. I'd say with this art book, you know, I kind of got to the point where I was feeling like pretty darn good about it. And then knowing that like a select number of people could actually help me kind of push it over the top. And so I asked Sasha Scott, American Indian art historian, asked my friend Jay Cook, who's a super, super smart American cultural historian, who had a lot of really great things to say about it. I asked Greg Crane, because he's kind of my best academic friend and teaching partner, English guy who knows how to do critical writing, you know, pretty good reader. I asked a curator, you know, in terms of sort of thinking about like, well, you know, how's this fit with a public audience, but also someone who is really detailed expertise in American Indian arts. And so I selected each one of them with a certain kind of role in mind. I didn't want to let my circle of readers get much larger than that. And each one of them has given me something kind of different, you know, different back. And so I'm doing one more, not total restructuring, but I'm taking some stuff out of the conclusion. I'm moving to the introduction. I'm setting up a thread that's going to actually carry through a little better, some through line. I'm going to chop a little. Right. So they all gave me certain kinds of things to think about, but I kind of waited till nearly the end.
Hey, Matt.
Yeah. So in Indians in Unexpected Places, you've got one of my favorite elements of the book, both the introduction and the conclusion, where in the introduction you start with this photograph that always makes people laugh. Mm-hmm. It's this Utamatai Lyle, this moment of affectivity. And then in the conclusion, you talk about this song that you hear that like enrages you and it ends in a headache. Right? And so I'm kind of curious, like, to me that's definitely your voice as a writer. And I love those moments where you're channeling something that you're feeling. And I think it works really, really effectively. And so I'm kind of wondering, like, at what point in your intellectual trajectory did you feel comfortable as a scholar to start making those kinds of moves? Because I always read that and I'm like super envious, and I'm just like, I'm not gutsy enough to do this kind of stuff in my own work. So I'd love to just kind of hear your thought process on that and evolution.
Yeah. Well, you know, so, I mean, I brought these books along just in case there was some occasion to read from it. I'm not going to read from it. But, like, you know, this is a dissertation book, you know, that got revised. And, you know, so the prose in this, the analysis is kind of, you know, I mean, at the time it was kind of high-end state-of-the-art, you know. They made me chop all the theoretical stuff out, you know, move it to the footnotes. My editor said, this is like a cake, and the cake is like this big, and the frosting is like this big. It's like, so you got to decide whether you're going to be a theory person, a lit crit theory person, oh, which you're not, by the way, and have it all be cake or frosting, or whether you're going to actually be a historian and have it all be cake, you know. So so the prose in this is not that exciting, but the conclusion, as I was writing the conclusion, there's two sets of pictures in here. There's this judge in Nebraska, and one he's dressed up in his Indian costume, and the other he's a judge. And, you know, I do remember I wrote the conclusion and the introduction kind of the very, very last thing. And frankly, after, you know, what, years with it as a dissertation, a couple years as a junior faculty member revising it, it really wasn't until the conclusion that I actually knew what the book was about, you know? It's like, this is true, those stories you hear. And I remember at that moment looking at the picture of the judge and feeling like a little bit of release around being able to sort of do. And so there is a kind of a personal, more of a personal riff in there, an affective kind of riff in there about, you know, colonialism in a book that's otherwise very, very measured, right? And then I think, so I would say that was kind of a little bit of a moment. And then I carried that over into, you know, Unexpected Places, which, as I said, really did kind of start with this kind of thing with my grandfather. And so affect was like really a critical and key kind of part to it at the, you know, at the beginning. And then the introduction to this is this kind of thing like, oh, here's this funny picture of this Indian woman, except it's not funny, right? Except it is funny, right? So I try to let the thing kind of linger as humor for as long as I can before sort of like pulling you back and saying, I mean, lots of readers don't like this, right? They're like, I didn't laugh at it. You know, you assumed that I laughed. And I'm like, yeah, I did, right? Exactly. Because maybe you didn't laugh, right? I mean, try to leave some space for people who didn't laugh, right? And mostly that was space, though, for indigenous people who didn't laugh, right? And so the language in this I tried to make very accessible to sort of hook readers in, but also, like, let them understand, like, actually, I'm kind of crabby about this, and you know, but I'm also I'm going to be empathetic to you as a reader because I don't have any privileged position on it either, right? Right? It's like racism, right? It's always there. Yeah.
Would you mind to read from that a little bit?
No.
I think this is something that we talk a lot about in writing classes, about voice and how it doesn't have to always sound as though it's an objective, omniscient voice from on high, but someone with a point of view.
Yeah. Matt, I'm kind of looking around for that place at the conclusion,
yeah,
actually.
Music.
Yeah.
Your son's music.
As I've been working on this book, my pre-adolescent son, he's now 24, has come to understand that he can define himself through the music he listens to, that even the crassest pop hit can wield emotional power, and that you can always find something to make your parents crazy. We go back and forth with one another. He loves beats and grooves. I long for melody. He likes hip-hop wordplay. I find his favorite lyrics pointless at best, in need of parental censorship at worst. He likes top 40 stations. I encourage him to check out college radio alternatives. He teases me with indecipherable kid speak. I toss faux intellectual observations back at him. Stuff like, a form has reached its most pathetic stage of decadence when it can only be self-referential. He is sometimes thrown for a moment, but then tosses down the card that wins every time, the slyly delivered question, Dad, did your parents like your music? This autumn of 2003, as he's decided to blast his boombox throughout the house, there's been a song that plays over and over again, Shake Ya Tail Feather by P. Diddy, Nelly, and Murphy Lee, which uses the tomahawk chop war chant as melodic wallpaper for its chorus. I avoid this song, but the war chant melody has this awful way of soaking down into you, repeating over and over again as a soundtrack for your life. One day in November, I snap just a little bit. There's a little extra edge in my voice as I yell at him, turn that song off. He is slow to act, however, and I find myself pleading, almost begging him to spare me. He knows something is up, and he's a little worried. I'm sorry, Dad, you have a headache. Yes, I snarl. It's a 500-year-old headache. It's called disrespect, injustice, and oppression. He is confused, and I suppose I'm unsubtle. It kind of goes on from there, but yeah.
That's great. We may have time for just one last question. This is sort of following on Katie's question about seeking out feedback. I was wondering if you could share for us any particular piece of feedback that you received and why it was, you know, so striking or transformative for any one of your works?
That's a really good question. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'd say the cake feedback was like was you know kind of high up on the list because, you know, like I started writing this thing. I started grad school in '88, right? So this is the moment of high theory, right? And in the American Studies program, we were so into it. And it didn't come that naturally to me. So all that theoretical stuff was kind of hard won. I, you know, discovered and fell in love with Walter Benjamin, who is like not that easy to actually, you know, kind of groove to. And so for me, actually, that advice, like all that stuff that was super hard won for you, right, move it to the footnotes. And then after you've moved it to the footnotes, you'll move it to an extra a file on your computer that you'll never look at again. I mean, my editor predicted all of these things exactly as they happen. So my first draft of this had these massively long discursive footnotes where I was talking about, you know, the dialectical image and, you know, all of this kind of stuff. And then, you know, they said, yeah, well, then, you know, you're over your word count. And then the next thing I knew, all those beautiful footnotes, all those years in graduate school, all that labor of theoretical reading was gone, right? It was in a file that's on a computer that cannot even be booted up anymore. It's kind of sad. So I would say, you know, I mean, that sort of sense, right? Which was, I mean, the advice was, like, understand what your book is, understand what your audience is, understand in the most pragmatic way how this will position you professionally, right? And I was in a history department. I wasn't in an English department. And, you know, it had to be a book that was legible to historians. My editor knew that in ways that I kind of didn't, I would say. Chuck Grinch, now the editor-in-chief at University of North Carolina Press. He's at Yale then. Yeah.
Phil, thank you so much for coming and speaking with us. I wish we could keep talking for another hour, but I know that we want to be careful about people's time. Yeah. So.
Well, I'm so honored and pleased that everybody came. I mean, it's really nice. Thank you all. Thank you all for coming.